The third case of the morning is number 01-1693, United Phosphorus Corporation against Angus Chemical Company. Mr. Katsaris.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Peter Katsaros, one of the attorneys for the appellant. Co-counsel Frederick Ryan is with me today. We represent United Phosphorus, Schrops United Chemicals, and J.C. Miller and Associates. Members of the court, this is a substantial antitrust case. It comes to this court following Magistrate Judge Levin's granting of a 12B1 motion to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. It appears from the minute order issued by the magistrate that he also granted summary judgment against all of the plaintiff's claims. The appeal presents three issues. First, whether Magistrate Levin committed reversible error by interpreting the Foreign Trade Antitrust Improvement Act to be a statute of subject matter jurisdiction as opposed to a substantive claim in an antitrust case. Secondly, whether he erroneously applied the standards applicable to Rule 56 to the motion for summary judgment brought by the defendants. And thirdly, whether he committed reversible error by dismissing the pendant claim for lack of supplemental jurisdiction. We ask for reversal and remand to a different judge. United Phosphorus is an international corporation based in Bombay, India, that sells worldwide, sells in the United States at the rate of about $20 million a year, has sales offices in Philadelphia, Kansas City, and San Diego. It has a slew of PhD chemists on its staff, engineers, and has received numerous awards in India for its manufacturing capability. The principal of J.C. Miller and Associates is a chemist who was the former vice president of research and development for the Angus Company, one of the Angus defendants. Schrapp and Miller combined to put together a group of business people and engineers to develop nitroparaffins for manufacture and sale worldwide, including the United States and the substantial market for nitroparaffins in the United States, which numbers in the tens of millions of dollars. And they put that business group together in June of 1991, and within months, by August, the monopolist, the Angus monopolist, had filed a sham lawsuit against them in the Cook County Circuit Court and had begun to knock off the various members of that business group so that they wouldn't do business with United Phosphorus. In addition to the sham lawsuit, the Angus defendants went to the major customers for AB in India and told those people that if you buy from our competitors, you are no longer a preferred customer of Angus. You will go on the spot market list, and we may not have supplies available for you if you buy for that competitor. That testimony is in the record. Then they tied up the customers with long-term contracts of 5 years or more. Then they intimidated someone who sold 1NP, brought him into a deposition, scared him away. He wouldn't be an agent for the plaintiffs. The evidence developed in this case shows that the Angus defendants and the Lupin defendants have what I call self-reinforcing monopolies. The Angus defendants have the monopolies in nitroparaffins. The Lupin defendants have a monopoly in the manufacture of AB, which is an intermediate product for the production of an anti-tuberculosis medicine. And Angus gives Lupin a price advantage, substantial amount, and has given them a price advantage for years which allows Lupin to lock in their market. That's the type of evidence that should have been on its way to a jury trial, but this trial judge found that there was no reasonable basis for that and granted summary judgment on those claims. We submit that that is reversible error. On the point of subject matter jurisdiction, Magistrate Judge Levin ignored a clear line of authority, starting with Bell v. Hood in 1946, followed by Steel Company, the Supreme Court case in 1998, followed by this court's decision in Sharp v. Jefferson in 1998, which basically says that in order to establish subject matter jurisdiction in a federal court, a plaintiff has to present a colorable, arguable claim under a federal statute or the Constitution. That claim has to be not frivolous. It should not be wholly insubstantial. Those are the words of Judge Easterbrook in Sharp. As long as that complaint goes that far, subject matter jurisdiction is conferred. We have a 30-page, fact-specific antitrust complaint in this case, which meets that standard. We have expert testimony developed in the record by the leading professors from Purdue University that helped develop this technology in the 1940s. All that was in the record. All that was ignored. You wouldn't even believe, you can read Judge Levin's case and not even believe that the plaintiff was litigating this case. In the record in this case, we have 315 additional facts with which we dispute the summary judgment motion. None of those is mentioned. None of those is distinguished. He doesn't explain why our witnesses are not credible. On the subject matter jurisdiction point, I would ask the court to review the Supreme Court decision in Hartford Fire. That was an antitrust case decided in 1993. The conduct at issue, the defendants were some insurers based in London. They were accused of conspiring to limit the availability of commercial general liability insurance in the state of California, and private companies in some states brought litigation. The U.S. Supreme Court decided that the Sherman Act had an extraterritorial reach and applied to that type of conduct. Anti-competitive conduct that occurred overseas that impacted the American economy in substantial ways was within the territorial scope of the Sherman Act. What we think is instructive about that case, Your Honors, is that the court decided that there was subject matter jurisdiction over that antitrust claim in the first few pages of the opinion. And then, after having decided subject matter jurisdiction, then refers to FATEA, this hurdle that we were unable to overcome with the trial judge, in a footnote. Just, you know, it was not part of the subject matter jurisdiction analysis that the court looked at. Now, we asked the court to look at the FATEA statute itself. There is no mention of jurisdiction in FATEA. The word does not appear. In the antitrust statutes, there are jurisdictional references. They appear earlier in the Sherman Act. They do not appear in FATEA. Congress knows how to write a statute. If Congress wanted to limit the jurisdiction of the courts, they would have amended the proper section. Jurisdiction does not appear.
Didn't the Second Circuit find that this was a subject matter jurisdiction issue?
I believe the Second Circuit did.
In that Sotheby Christie case, last about 3 weeks ago.
I'm not familiar with that, Your Honor. But if you would like us to brief it in a supplemental letter, I'd be happy to do that.
I mean, the Second Circuit, as I understand it, in that case, held that this provision is a matter that goes to subject matter jurisdiction of the court. And if so, then resolvable under Rule 12b.
Again, I'm not familiar with that case. But if you'd like us to research it and provide you with our view on it, we'd be happy to do that. The court in Sharp versus Jefferson looked at Title VII and looked at the applicability of the 15-employee rule. And Judge Easterbrook said, a colorable claim under a federal statute confers subject matter jurisdiction, and that's the end of it. The Supreme Court in Steel Company interpreted a federal statute, EPCRA, found subject matter jurisdiction, and we believe that those should be controlling authorities here. Earlier in the case, in the first 6 months of the case, in October of 1994, Judge Maravich, the first district judge that had this case, ruled in the favor of the plaintiffs and found subject matter jurisdiction, denied a 12B1 motion. That should have been the end of it as well. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Casares. We'll hear now from Mr. McLaughlin.
May it please the court, Judge Ripple, Judge Caney, Judge Evans, Judge Morioka, Mark McLaughlin, on behalf of the defendants, good morning. At the close of a 4.5-year period of discovery in this case, the undisputed facts, largely testimony and documents from the plaintiffs themselves, revealed that the conduct the plaintiffs challenged in their antitrust claims had an impact, if at all, in India, and did not have the direct, substantial, and reasonably foreseeable impact on domestic commerce that the Foreign Trade Antitrust Improvements Act requires. As a result, the record in this case requires the same result, that is, affirmance, no matter what the mode of analysis. In the first instance, the proper method of analysis we submit is the one followed by the district court. The language of the FTAIA establishes the domestic impact standard as a threshold or gatekeeper issue. The legislative history bolsters that conclusion by emphasizing expressly and repeatedly that the ability to meet the domestic impact test is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. As a result, we cast our motion below as one that was based on plaintiffs' failure to carry their burden of showing that the court had subject matter jurisdiction over this type of claim. In doing so, we also considered the fact that every court that has addressed the domestic impact requirement of the FTAIA has said that the issue is one of subject matter jurisdiction. We believe that the law compelled us to treat the issue as one of subject matter jurisdiction, and that the court below was entirely correct in following that law in dismissing the antitrust claims for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Second, though, even if the domestic impact requirement were an element of an antitrust claim, the undisputed facts show that the defendants were entitled to summary judgment under Rule 56. Plaintiffs asked the court to repudiate the well-settled mode of analysis adopted by courts both before and after the district court's decision here, and plaintiffs asked this court to hold that the need for plaintiffs to show direct, substantial, and reasonably foreseeable impact on domestic commerce was simply another element of their antitrust claims. In plaintiffs' way of looking at things, any failure of proof before trial must be measured by the standards of Rule 56, that is, whether plaintiffs raised a genuine issue of material fact in support of the domestic impact requirement. The district court opinion here and the record reveals that plaintiffs did not create such an issue in support of their claims. Specifically, the district court here did not resolve contested fact issues in its determination that there was no domestic impact here. Indeed, the court below repeatedly emphasized in its opinion that the facts were undisputed and concluded at page 1022 of the reported opinion, quote, that the undisputed record shows no direct, substantial, and reasonably foreseeable effect on domestic commerce under the FTAIA. Our motions had sought dismissal under either Rule 12b1 or Rule 56. consistent with the language in the court's opinion, both the minute order announcing the disposition of the motions and the final judgment said that defendant's motions to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction and for summary judgment are granted. As a result, even if plaintiffs were correct in their view of the law, and this were a Rule 56 issue, and no case supports them on this record the result is the same, because after all this period of time of discovery, the record shows no genuine issue of material fact in support of their claim that the trade secret lawsuit that Angus pursued against plaintiffs based on their announced plan to make AB in India had the required impact on domestic commerce. Now, for a little bit more detail on the subject matter jurisdiction test. The Supreme Court in the Ruhr Gas versus Marathon Oil case, cited in the brief, defined subject matter jurisdiction as authority over the category of claim in suit. In the FTAIA, the Congress used the type of language that confers authority on the federal courts for certain categories of claims and withholds authority from the federal courts for an entire other category when it said that the Sherman Act, quote, shall not apply, end quote, to suits without the required domestic impact. The legislative history cited in the brief confirms Congress's intent to create a threshold and a jurisdictional test. For example, the House Committee report in our appendix at page 23 expressly states, quote, it is the intent of the sponsors of the legislation and the committee to address only the subject matter jurisdiction of the United States antitrust law in this legislation. H.R. 5235 does not affect the legal standards for determining whether conduct violates the antitrust laws, and thus the substantial antitrust issues on the merits of a claim would remain unchanged. That second sentence is repeated elsewhere in the same legislative history using the term substantive instead of substantial. In addition to the legislative history, the federal antitrust enforcement authorities agree that this is a jurisdictional issue. Most recently in the brief that the Solicitor General filed in the Supreme Court in the State Oil case as to which the Supreme Court has denied cert. And all of the cases that have addressed the issue, as recently as the Christie's case last month that Judge Evans mentioned, and there have been an increasing number of those cases in the last 2 years, all of those cases agree that the FTAIA establishes a threshold issue, one that must be pleaded first to withstand facial attack and then proven to withstand factual attack. Plaintiffs demean this mountain of case law as nothing more than a series of what they say are drive-by jurisdictional rulings that this court should ignore. To the contrary, the courts in all these cases regularly articulate the duty of the federal courts to address, on their own initiative, if not raised by the parties, the question of subject matter jurisdiction, and they stress the importance of that inquiry. After doing so, they, in each instance, treat as a threshold jurisdictional matter the obligation of the plaintiff to prove, not merely to plead, but to prove that its claim involves a direct, substantial, and reasonably foreseeable impact on domestic commerce. Plaintiffs also seek to invoke cases like Steel Company versus Citizens for a Better Environment and the other cases that Mr. Katsaros mentioned. But those cases simply articulate the principle that a federal court does not lose subject matter jurisdiction when it appears doubtful that a plaintiff might prove its claim. Those cases do not address the ability of Congress to establish threshold jurisdictional issues, and they do not repudiate the long line of cases in this court and elsewhere that explain how courts must address challenges to subject matter jurisdiction. Here, once Judge Levin, the district court, properly determined that the FTAA test was a threshold jurisdictional matter, the court followed step by step the procedure that the Supreme Court and this court and courts everywhere have endorsed.
Why is this situation different than the one that the counsel talked about, Judge Easterbrook's opinion on 15 employees in the Title VII case?
Your Honor, that was a case in which the 15, that was the Sharp case, was one in which the 15 employee issue was part of the definitional elements in the statute, whether a particular entity met the definition of an employee. And that's different, including meeting a definition in the statute, that is, deciding whether that statute covers this particular situation, is different from a case in which we have here a separate statute passed by Congress long after the Sherman Act, expressly setting forth the type of threshold jurisdictional case. The Second Circuit in the De Silva case that plaintiffs cite in their brief, note that was also a 15-employee case, and that court expressed at some length, or discussed at some length, how you go about distinguishing subject matter jurisdictional issues from matters on the merits, and cited the restatement of judgments for the proposition that sometimes it's not easy, and it has not been easy in those 15-employee cases. One of the key things that the Second Circuit said in that case you look to is what is called the accumulation of categorizing decisions, and that helps the courts make the decision. In this case, unlike in the 15-employee case, accumulation of categorizing decisions is universal, that this is a threshold issue not simply related to the merits of the case, and that the merits of an antitrust claim remain the same after the passage of FTAIA. With the white light on, Your Honor, I'd like to turn to the summary judgment standard in this case. As to that, plaintiff's own statements defeat any claim that they could have or would have sold AB in the United States. As the district court correctly noted, that was the only product as to which plaintiffs had taken even preliminary steps to make. The cornerstone of their plan was to make AB, an ingredient in a tuberculosis treatment, ethambutol, in India, for sale to pharmaceutical companies to make ethambutol in India to treat the patients who are afflicted with that disease, which is rampant in India. Consistent with that reality, the plaintiff's witnesses testified that the only potential customers that they spoke to were ethambutol makers in India. Mr. Schroff, the principal of the Indian plaintiffs, acknowledged that he knew of no uses for AB other than in making ethambutol. The record also establishes, once again, in uncontroverted fashion, that there was no ethambutol made in the United States during any relevant time period. Some ethambutol, to be sure, is used here, but it is made in Italy by Letterly, a unit of Letterly, and that's the only importer into the United States authorized by the Food and Drug Administration. Plaintiffs admitted they never talked to Letterly about the prospect of selling it AB. During the entire period at issue here, Angus's only U.S. customer for AB has been 3M, which buys small amounts of it from time to time for use in making a product used in rocket motors. Plaintiffs did not know of that use for AB, which in the 3 years at issue here represented less than 0.5% of the world's usage of AB. The 3M buyer testified, again, without contradiction, that for the small amounts that AB buys, it would not have taken the risk of switching suppliers. Plaintiffs mentioned in a brief that, oh, they might have sold AB to laboratory supply houses in the United States. Again, with a 4.5-year discovery record, the only evidence as to lab supply houses is that plaintiffs never talked to them, and there's no evidence that they ever bought any AB from Angus or from Grace during the periods of time that those companies have sold AB. They also claim that Mitsubishi bought some AB. Of course, Mitsubishi bought AB from Germany for use in China. The billing address was in Manhattan. There's been no AB sold to Mitsubishi in New York. As to the other products that were even far behind AB, the testimony unequivocally, without dispute, cited in the briefs, indicates that as to each of those products, the plaintiffs only had conjectural, down-the-road plans. As to one of those products, that the testimony of Mr. Schroff is key. He put it at the page of his deposition that's at page 164 of our appendix. When I asked him about that product, we may need it, we may not need it. Depends on circumstances. Today, I can't tell. That testimony, which is consistent with the testimony as to each of the products, reflects that there's no genuine issue of material fact in support of any claim that the plaintiffs would have sold any products in the United States or that any action of Angus of which the plaintiffs complain would have had the required direct, substantial, and reasonably foreseeable impact in the United States. Thank you to the court for the opportunity to appear.
Thank you, Mr. McLaughlin. You have 4 minutes, Mr. Katsouras.
Judge Evans, I apologize for not being up to date on Christie's. That case was a Second Circuit case that found FATEA was jurisdictional. We do not think it is persuasive authority because the analysis is lacking in the opinion, and we do not think it provides guidance to this court. As to the point made by Angus's attorneys regarding legislative history, we would ask the court to consider City of Chicago versus Environmental Defense Fund. The U.S. Supreme Court in the 1990s decided that case and specifically said that a court should look at the statutory language. That statutory language trumps legislative history. Again, the statutory language in FATEA, jurisdiction is not used. It does not appear in the jurisdictional section of the Sherman Act, and it is an element, we contend, of the substantive claim. Now, as to the contentions that there are non-disputed facts in this case, admitting that it's not a subject matter jurisdictional point, Judge Manning was the second federal judge to have this case. And when she decided the motion to dismiss brought by the Lupin defendants for personal jurisdiction, she had a substantial evidentiary record before her by the plaintiffs. She found, in denying that motion, that there were reasonable inferences of anti-competitive intent by the Lupin defendants and the Angus defendants, that they were trying to keep the plaintiffs out of the market. That's typical of the rest of the record, which I'm sure you will study. Counsel for Angus focuses on AB. Our amended complaint talks about our client's intent to make 7 or 8 different chemicals, TA, AMP, 1NP, AB, Bronopol, others. And there, it is undisputed that the market for AMP and TA in the United States is in the tens of millions of dollars. AB is a smaller product, 1NP is a smaller product, TA and AMP do produce a substantial impact on American commerce. Angus would have you just count noses, count the Court of Appeals opinions. This court has a reputation for doing analysis. And Sharp versus Jefferson and the Hartford Fire case, we believe, points us in the direction that this statute is not subject matter jurisdictional. As to our client's intent to make these chemicals and our ability, there's a memo published by Mr. Hughes, who was a former marketing director for the defendant, that tells his superiors, Mr. Schroff of UPL and John C. Miller can hurt you. These two people have the expertise to hurt you if they get into this business. And that is certainly a basis for denying summary judgment because it presents a material issue of fact. So we believe that this court in Sharp versus Jefferson really has set the standard for establishing subject matter jurisdiction, and there is nothing in this statute to indicate that it's a subject matter jurisdictional issue. We would ask that you reverse. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Katsouras. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under